So this is part three of the Where Did the Road Go midweek podcast, top stories of 2015. We have Red Pill Junkie and Joshua Crutchin. We're missing Michael Hughes because I believe he has been taken by Bigfoot.
call David Politis.
Hey, that's not fair. David doesn't actually support that idea.
No, I just meant Michael's missing.
Oh, okay. All right. Maybe he was abducted by an alien.
Yeah.
But either way, it's just the three of us tonight as we finish off, I hope the top stories of 2015. There's still quite a few here.
Yeah, it's interesting. It didn't really feel like a big year, but it's taken us long enough to wade through it, hasn't it?
One of the things we missed that really should be one of the top stories is that Art Bell came back and left.
Yeah. And I must confess, I never was a big Art Bell fan. You know, as a Mexican, I never listened too much to Coast to Coast, although I know that he had a huge influence in the way that the modern ufological and paranormal field has developed. I mean, I think that 90% of people who have a paranormal podcast is because they want to be like Art Bell.
Yeah, I would say so. And I actually never even listened to his show when he came back, and then all of a sudden he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So and it really hasn't been a lot of information as to what happened. Apparently someone took some shots at him that was stalking him, and he just said the hell with this and walked away.
And this was the second time or the third time that he quit? Exactly. I can't recall.
I believe it's when he was originally on Coast to Coast, there were some issues. And if I remember right from when he came back on Sirius, he said that Clear Channel or whoever it was that was running Coast to Coast at the time was all about standing behind him, and then they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he cleared himself of all the charges that were going against him and proved himself innocent, they were all willing to take him back, but they had jumped the commercials up so much. He was like, I don't want this many commercials on my show. And they were like, well, you know, and so eventually he quit.
Mm.
And then he came onto Sirius. And I guess the issue with Sirius was that he wanted people to have access to the show. Yeah. Like, he wanted to be able to stream it online,
yeah.
And Sirius wasn't going for it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, their whole model is that you have to pay for their satellite radio.
Exactly.
So he had issues with that, and eventually he quit and then waited out his contract for that. And meanwhile, his producer, started up Dark Matter Radio.
Mm-hmm. Right, and there was a little bit of... some people were a little bit upset about that because it... very closely mirrored Don Ecker's Dark Matters radio, which was already extant at the time. So I know that some people were sort of upset about that.
Yeah.
You know, and I was thrilled that they asked to carry Where'd the Road Go. So, I mean, we're still on Dark Matter Radio. It's still there. But the whole point of it was to give Art Bell an outlet that people, you know, they build it up and then he comes back and there he is. And he's there for what, 3 months or so, if that?
Okay, mm-hmm. So what exactly did he do on those 3 months? And also when he was on Sirius Radio, I think that one of the things that disappointed his fans the most was that he was pretty much inviting all the old guests that he had on Coast to Coast 20 years ago.
Including the screaming alien guy that had been proven to be a fake.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus.
That was the one that confused me, but I think the problem was he was having one guest for 4 hours with very few commercials on Sirius, and I would listen to it, and after a while I'd be like, you know, I think we've gotten through the bulk of the interview, and there's not really a whole lot left here for the next 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, even Joe Rogan doesn't go for 4 hours. I mean, three the most.
Well, there's some people you can talk to for 3 hours easily. There's some people you could talk to for 12 hours easily. You know, we may do two-hour podcasts here, but we usually end up talking 4 to 5 hours.
That's very true.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have someone like Graham Hancock on, it's not hard to just let Graham talk for 3 hours.
Yeah, for sure.
Whitley Strieber, same thing. I mean, there's so much stuff I'd love to talk to Whitley Strieber about. That I could easily do a 5-hour show with Whitley Strieber.
And those are the superstars, you know, of the field.
Yeah.
one of the things that I appreciate the most about, you know, podcast, like Where Did the Road Go, my friends in Great America, is that you guys also give airtime to people who are not as known as the Whitley Strievers and the Graham
Nichols.
Well, not as known, and also you know, people that I think that the people that I admire are the ones who will have people on that will challenge them, not like you know, not antagonistically, but will challenge their viewpoints. And I think that that, you know, Graham and Darren are good about that, and you're good about that, Soraya, and
Yeah, I actually look for some of the guests who haven't been all over the place before, because I want to offer something different.
It's the only way that you grow, too, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not that I would, you know, that I don't want Graham Hancock and Whitley Strieber on the show. It's that I also want all these other, like Joshua, like you. I mean, you know, you had, as soon as I heard about your book on the Graelian Report, the first time you went on there, I was like, I want to have this guy on. This is really interesting.
Oh, shucks.
And then you contacted me, and I'm like, oh, you beat me to it. All right.
Well, it's like we were talking about earlier, you know, part of the reason that, and this is we're totally getting off topic here, but part of the reason that I want to get involved in this is so I could have conversations like the ones that we're having right now with guys like y'all. Because I mean, it's kind of funny. Once you have a couple of these conversations, like we have, or like you're talking with people who are involved in these subjects, it kind of gets a little bit hard to go back out into the real world and talk about baseball and the weather, you know?
I just don't do that.
Yeah, it's, well, I'm trying. But back to the whole, Art Bell thing with him leaving. It's just the whole thing, watching it from afar, as someone who hasn't really been following his programs, lately, it just all feels real, real baffling. And it's almost one of those things that it feels like, I'm not saying this is what happened at all, but it almost feels like, hey, I want out. You won't let me out. We'll find that. I'll keep on, you know, coming up with reasons to get out. It's sort of the way it looks from the outside. Now, I don't know if that's the way it is or not, but it sort of feels that way.
Someone had suggested to me that his return didn't generate the ratings that they expected, and maybe he was just kind of ducking out and making up excuses. I have no idea if there's any reality to that whatsoever. If someone was actually stalking him to the point of taking shots at him, like, I don't know how I would react to that if that happened to me.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly wouldn't be happy about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have friends in the field who have been effectively driven out because of stalkers.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can't, if that's what really happened, you can't blame him for that, for worrying about the safety of his family and himself. So who knows? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of details out there on it.
Well, and it comes back to what we talk about all the time. You know, there's no way of knowing what somebody else is going through. And I think that I would encourage anybody to be interested in these sort of fields, because I do think it in some way makes you a more compassionate person, because you meet people who are going through certain things, and, you know, from the outside, it might look really odd. So it almost forces you to have this sort of, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt for what they're going through.
Yeah. All right. So let's see. This is one I added into Red Pill's list here, because Red Pill compiled a lot of these stories, and a lot of them came from the Daily Grail as well, which is an excellent website. But one of the things I noticed happening a lot this year, which amused me greatly, is the Church of Satan has been really kind of doing some publicity work.
Oh, yeah.
and I don't know if it happened this year or last year, where they were going to erect the statue of Baphomet.
Uh-huh.
You know, because they had the thing of the Ten Commandments, and they're like, oh, well, if, you know, there's religious freedom, we're going to put our statue up.
Yeah.
And then there was their whole thing with the Hobby Lobby, where they went after them. There was the comic book. Have you guys seen the comic book?
No.
Or the coloring book? The coloring book. Oh, my God. The coloring book is hilarious. And they wanted to, because there was religious propaganda being given out in the school in Florida, they said, oh, well, we have some religious propaganda. So they made a satanic coloring book. you can find it on whatever the website, the group that did it, and it's all about tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about treating people equally and not, you know, discriminating against people and so on and so forth. There's nothing negative in the entire coloring book, but the school system freaked out, and I guess they pulled all the religious pamphlets off.
Mm. Yeah, so you know, it's the
modern version of Satanism, which I think is like a very histrionic way of atheism, right? You know, I mean,
sort of.
I mean, this is the thing that Anthony LaVey was.
Anton LaVey. Yeah, LaVey created it in opposition to what he thought was a lot of hypocrisy in religion, and you know, to him, Satan wasn't a deity to be worshipped. It was opposition to the mainstream.
Yeah, it was opposition to what he saw as, you know, fundamentalist churches,
He was a cop in San Francisco, and he would see these people do horrible, horrible things during the week, and then go to church on Sunday and confess their sins and be forgiven.
Yeah, and I think that there's a point in that. I personally have a problem with the nomenclature, because I do think that there are negative forces of some type out there in the universe, and I feel like there are more. Personally, for me, there are more accurate ways to represent the ideals of LaVey's line of thought, if that makes any sense.
But I think he did it for shock value.
Oh yeah, I understand what he was going for, but you know, to me, it almost, you know, it's sort of the same reason that I don't play with Ouija boards. You know, it's one of those things where I think that there's something out there, and I don't want to sort of poke the animal in the cage, as it were.
Well, when you look at the origins of the whole satanic concept, I mean, in Christianity, it wasn't there to begin with. It's been added in over the years as something to scare people with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
You know, Satan just means opposer, you know, opposition. It's the alternate, you know, it's the devil's advocate.
Well, right. And you look at the etymology of the word Lucifer, meaning, you know, just one who brings, you know, light bringer. Yeah, exactly.
In the ancient Testament, it's the idea that Satan is not like like in opposition with God. He's actually something of an ally of God. He's like the prosecutor who goes and says, you know, this guy doesn't deserve to be saved because of this and this and this. You know, and there's also the story of Job. You know, showing Satan, like, you know, going and chatting with God and being welcomed into heaven and whatever. No, nobody stopping them and say, hey, what are you doing here? You know, your place is below in the flames. So it's the way in which this thing has been twisted in order to, well, obviously, to scare us into saying, you know, you better behave within this very narrow moral code, or else, you're going to go into a very bad place, because that's the way God, you know, your father who loves you so much, wants you to. Not just because you did this little thing.
But I mean, they've been really just kind of screwing with the religious right that are trying to push their values into areas where it should not be.
They have stayed in the news very, very well this year. Yeah, that's for sure.
In America, because, well, as an outsider, I see America as such a contradiction, you know, such a place with such righteous religious morality, you know, in juxtaposition with the capitalist search for pleasure and, you know, in this life, you know, that on the one hand we have this idea that we better enjoy everything we can in this life because this is the one shot we have, and on the other we have all these people who have these such medieval conceptions about God and morality, and they think that the world is only 6,000 years old, and it's pretty surreal if you think about it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, and there's definitely this weird undercurrent with fundamental Christianism and Christianism, fundamental Christianity, and this idea that the world is disposable, which I cringe at.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if we know neither the day nor the hour, even if you ascribe to a fundamental version of Christianity, it makes sense to, you know, well, maybe Jesus is coming tomorrow. Maybe he's coming in 5,000 years. If he's coming in 5,000 years, you better do a good job of taking care of the planet for the rest of the people on down the road. You know, I've never understood the logic in that, really.
Yeah, yeah, I think the latest thing I saw from the Church of Satan was when they posted maybe a month back when there was a lot of anti-Islamic sort of speech going on. They posted a few tweets saying, "Hey, you know, if anyone in the Chicago area who's Islamic wants escorts, you know, to go out in public, we at the Church of Satan would be more than happy to take you from point A to point B so you get there safely."
Yeah. Reminds you of the writer Salman Rushdie, you know, who was being given a contract for his life or for writing the satanic verses.
Yep. But I've been very amused at their activities over the last year.
Yeah, it's almost like they're. It's a version of atheism with a sense of humor.
Yeah, that's very much what it is, because they don't worship it.
Right, exactly.
Okay, in a way, so they are like this, the Discordians of the 1960s and 1970s, but I wonder if the, you know, the Discordians, they started that the faux religion out of, you know, for fun, you know, for we will say now for the lulz. But they did get some weird result out of it. You know, they did get some weird manifestations. You know, Aries in the end started trolling them. So I like Joshua, I'm wondering if the Satanists, if a few Satanists have reported some weird manifestations in their life. You know, out of
I'm sure they have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are magical occult aspects to it as well. If people want to adopt that, I mean, LaVey in the Satanic Bible took the Enochian keys and changed them around to make them a little less. I don't want to say religious because they weren't really religious to begin with. Less mystical. And considered them angles of reality rather than angels.
Ah. Interesting twist of words, yeah.
So Satanists aren't necessarily against the ideas of magic. It's just they don't have a organized belief system in a deity that rules over them or anything like that. Satan's just a concept of individual freedom.
Mm.
For everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom for everybody and responsibility for yourself. So it's almost libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on to this weird star that brought Dyson spheres into the public domain. And that was KIC 84628532. Cool. And it was spotted by the Kepler Space Telescope. And its drop in light had scientists puzzled to the point where they were suggesting maybe there's an alien civilization there.
Mm-hmm. And then they determined that it was probably a comet eventually, right?
And there is an article that was just posted today on Gizmodo.
I just saw that myself.
It's not likely to be comets.
Which, yeah, it's interesting. I feel like in some ways it's the most promising story that we've had in a long time. In these sort of areas, because it is so anomalous.
Andrew Collins really liked this one because it lines up with the light, I think it's from Cygnus, where he believes that radiation from Cygnus is what jump-started our intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
And so he's saying if this, you know, is along the same path and it's closer, they may have gotten an even bigger burst from whatever this radiation was.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I remember we talked about this at the time about what this would mean for non-traditional ufologists if this was proved to be an extraterrestrial civilization. But you know, it's interesting, and I feel like in some ways I'm frustrated by it because I feel like even if it is something anomalous, it's going to be forever before we can determine whether or not it's actually something genuinely anomalous.
Well, that's true. That is.
But like yeah,
the signal was detected in I think it was in the Ohio Big Ear radio telescope in 1977, and now they're saying that signal was also, ironically enough, caused by two comets passing.
Yep.
You know, and interestingly enough, that theory was proposed by Antonio Paris, who is an astronomer, but he's also a ufologist.
Huh. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But the thing is that we can test because those same comets are coming back, I think, in 2016 or 2017, something like that. They're coming back in the next few years, so we can just point it out and see if we get the same result.
Nice. That'll be great.
Yeah. So if we get another wow signal while they're passing, wow signal solved. If not, then that wasn't it.
Yeah, this is I think, in a lot of ways, this is this generation's wow signal. I feel pretty comfortable saying that because and like the wow signal, I think it'll probably be a wash in ambiguity for the next two decades, probably. you know, because even which I mean even good. Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, which is good. I mean, ambiguity triggers creativity.
Very true.
So let's move on to Antikythera. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened this year is the return to Antikythera, where they went back to where this 2,000-plus-year-old computer was found and started pulling up more of the wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of stuff down there. And for anyone who doesn't know what the Antikythera device is, it's a very advanced, essentially manual computer that plots sun movement, moon movement, down to incredible amounts of detail. Yes. And way beyond what was supposed to exist at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like finding an iPod in Abraham Lincoln's tomb, you know?
Yeah.
To that effect.
And that's one of those things that science can't just ignore. They can't say, that's nothing. No, that's definitely something, and it's way more advanced than it should be, and it's not likely to have just spontaneously come about like that. That couldn't have been like the first try.
Exactly. That wasn't the prototype.
So where are the rest of them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and what else haven't we discovered?
You know, that's just it. I feel like we have discovered quite a few out-of-place artifacts that are extremely anomalous, and for some reason, you know, I guess it's the same shadowy organization that that keeps on shutting out Graham Hancock's research. But I don't know why some of these things haven't garnered more attention than they have.
What's your favorite out of place objects?
It was the Iraqi battery. I don't know what they call it. The Baghdad battery. That's what it was.
Yes.
Which I think is something that has not had nearly enough attention go into it. And don't ask me to elaborate on that because it's been a long time since I've read about it, but I remember being fascinated by it at the time.
Well, that was something Jason Martell made a model of. I mean, he took what they found and he said, could this actually work as a battery? And he made an exact copy of it with, you know, new, and showed that, yeah, this is a battery. This works. They could have used it to plate gold on things. They could have used it for any number of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that's – I'm always fascinated by the stuff found in coal mines. where you get these you know lumps of coal, and they open it up, and there's a fancy gold chain there.
Or the entombed animals that Charles Fort was always such a fan of.
Like especially frogs.
Yeah, those are. I don't even know what to make out of those. Returning back to the Antikythera thing, I mean, even if it was something that appeared to be entirely non-functional, it makes you wonder sometimes. I mean, if you took an iPhone back to, you know, the year 500, they wouldn't know what to do with it, and it was powered down. It wouldn't even look like technology. It would just look like a thing. You know, a bunch of metal and a bunch of, you know, strange materials, but it wouldn't necessarily look like it was any sort of advanced technology. It would just look out of place, odd. So it makes you wonder how many things we haven't even given a second thought to that are actually utilizing some form of technology or some form of power that we haven't even thought about harnessing yet. It really makes you wonder if we've ever run into more stuff like this than we realize.
Certainly.
I recently read something about this exhibition, I think it's in London, about John Dee. They're going to show a lot of his books and a lot of the artifacts he owned, including this scrying mirror, you know, that is made out of black obsidian that was actually came from Mexico, you know, from I think it was made by the Aztecs, right? So if you see that, and I wonder what John Dee would have thought of something like an iPad, you know, maybe he will see that and will use it as a scrying mirror, right? Because it's also a piece of black glass.
Sure.
So maybe, I don't know, maybe there's something in his scrying mirror that if we knew how to press the on button, you know.
Exactly.
We'll let you have a Skype conversation with the angel Uriel.
I would suspect stuff like that works very strongly on altered states of consciousness.
Oh, for sure.
But, going back to the coal mine thing, I mean, either people long, long, long time ago were building stuff that's very similar to stuff we build today, or maybe coal's not as old as we think it is.
Yeah, I mean, because for it to contain things like the, gold chains or something, I mean, it doesn't make any sense in terms of what we perceive as, you know, as in terms of the geological development of coal. It's a complete geological non sequitur.
Yeah, it would have to be millions of years old.
Yeah.
So for it to be deep in a coal vein, it would have to be millions of years old.
Yeah. And millions of years old. I mean, that's even beyond what Graham's talking about. You know?
No, it's online with like Michael Cremo's stuff.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I find Michael Cremo's stuff interesting. I can't easily dismiss it. I mean, there's definitely some anomalous discoveries that, you know, who knows what we don't know about our past.
I mean, or we have a completely upside-down version or upside-down perception of what time means. You know, that's another option.
You look at the cycles of time, too, when you deal with, like... the great year and stuff, that it goes from golden age to dark age and back to golden age. And in the dark age, everything from the golden age is pretty much erased.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How many times has that happened for, you know, this idea to have surfaced at all in human history?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, really interesting.
And when you look at back at, you know, some of these ancient cultures, they'll say that. There have been many advanced cultures before, and they've been washed away, you know, in floods and et cetera, et cetera. So who knows?
Yeah, so maybe what's the secret? You know, what will finally let us pass the level and, you know, defeat the miniboss?
Yeah, exactly. let's see, keeping it with archaeology and stuff, there was the Homo naledi discovery,
mm-hmm.
which is a new hominin, yet another new hominin. They keep finding them.
Yet another, yeah. It's our world started to become not unlike Tolkien's Lord of the Rings with all these races, you know, the elves and the orcs and the dwarves and the men, yep. And of course the hobbits.
Yeah, I mean, oh, and the greys and the elves. Giants. And, yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Bigfoot are the giants, and the greys are the elves, and the hobbits are the Homo floresiensis. And the... No, I totally take your meaning. Yeah, that's a good point.
Nordics are the elves, Joshua.
That's right.
One of the interesting things they did with the Homo naledi skull is that they used a 3D printer to kind of reconstruct it out of the missing parts. Mm-hmm. So that's a technology that definitely, I mean, it seems sort of pointless when it first came up. It's like, so what are we going to do with this? You know, and now it's like, oh, we're going to do all these things with it. That's really cool. All right.
Yeah, I remember reading in Michael Crichton's The Lost World how paleontologists and archaeologists will no longer require to dig stuff from the ground. They will detect it with ground penetrating radar, and then using things like a 3D printer, you know, create an almost instantaneous copy of the thing that they don't even have to dig up in order to study. So they can preserve the past, leave it intact.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see. So then, I don't know if we covered this one or not. Waiting for the page to open so I can tell you. The La Ciudad Blanca?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the White City.
Oh, yes, that's what it was, the White City.
Yeah.
The City of the Monkey God, which has been found, and it perfect for what you were just talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a fascinating story, and it's always... We like to think that we live in this era where everything is where Google Earth has charted everything, but it's always reassuring to see that these, you know, unmapped corners of the world sort of yield really promising new results like that.
Mm-hmm. Also, the fact that like 25 years ago there was this notion that in the Americas, only in Mesoamerica and Central America, there was this advanced civilizations that would make complex stone temples, you know, erect cities like Teotihuacan, Chichen Itza, or in Peru, you know, Machu Picchu, Cusco, and the like, right? But in places like the Amazonian jungle, no, the natives were still living as hunter-gatherers, and in a very more primitive lifestyle. But now we're using these same modern technologies, you know, see these ground penetrating radars, these lidars. We're finding all these lost cities, you know, in the middle of the jungle, you know, and completely rewriting our notion of how the Americas were populated thousands of years before Columbus.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you're seeing that even in Egypt, too, as they're finding things under the sand that weren't obvious because they were just out in the middle of the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's also interesting about with the whole White City thing, the consistency of motifs between cultures, you know, the were jaguars that they found. It's really interesting to see that motif represented so strongly there. And I think I was just hearing something the other day about being a city of the monkey people kind of had some allusions to being a city of large hairy hominids, which is another interesting connection there too. I think that's still developing, but.
All right. One of the things you wrote, and I think I know what you're talking about here, was the genetic connection between Australia and, is it South America?
Yeah, I think it was one of the articles that Greg Taylor posted. Some recent genetic studies, you know, I mean, we are using these modern techniques in order to find things that would have been completely impossible to elucidate 100 years ago, when scientists only resorted to using bones and comparative comparative studies. Now, apparently, someone did a DNA study and found genetic markers linking Australian Aborigines with natives in South America, and that's something that further shows that we really have missed a big chunk of our past. You know, I mean, Graham Hancock have said it so eloquently. We're a species with amnesia. We really don't know what happened with our ourselves, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago.
And I can't remember if I said this last time we spoke or I wanted to say this, but I feel like the Native Australian Aboriginal culture is one of the most underappreciated cultures in terms of the current worldview of how advanced they were and have been. I mean, I think that there's a lot more going on there than people really are aware of. I mean, we did mention last time the presence of I believe it was eucalyptus trees in Egypt. Is that right? In mummies' tombs.
You mentioned cocaine. I don't think you mentioned eucalyptus.
Okay, well, I think there is some tangential evidence for, you know, cross visitation between other cultures in Australia, and I don't think that was one-sided. I don't think that was people coming to the Aboriginal culture. I think that there's the potential for them to be a lot more advanced than a lot of people realize, and I feel like it's one of those cultures that still has a lot of mystery on it because it is such an ancient culture and such a rich culture that it's definitely something that is worthy of further interest, that's for sure.
And like David Hatcher Childress liked to say, you know, and I don't know if he came up with it, but I know he said it a lot, that, you know, oceans are freeways, not obstacles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Have you guys just watched the movie The Last Wait?
The Last Wait?
Wait. It's a 1970 Australian movie with starring Richard Chamberlain and also a few Aboriginal actors, and it's a really interesting story because it touches upon all this idea of contact between Australian Aborigines and other ancient civilizations in the past.
Interesting.
Also, it has apocalyptic overtones. You know, it's very surreal, almost like dreamlike in the narrative. I recommend you guys check it out if you can. You know, either
spell,
on YouTube.
Spell the last word.
Wave.
Wave.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page, and it's really, really fascinating looking.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen it. Although, I don't know. It's ringing out. I'm looking at IMDb, and it does kind of ring a vague bell.
Mm-hmm.
If I did see it, it was a while back. So let's stay in the Central American area. And we had a sinkhole discovered under Kuklan's temple.
Yeah, I wrote that one at the Daily Grail. I think it was November of last year.
August.
Oh, August, you know.
I have it in front of me.
So much for my memory. So why is this interesting? You know, well, aside from some foolish nationalist pride, you know, of finding cool stuff in your own country, the name Chichen Itza, you know, this famous Mayan city in the Yucatan Peninsula, literally means the city of the water wizards, something to that effect. And here you have the most prominent temple in this city, built right on top this natural sinkhole that the Mayas called cenotes. And the cenotes were incredibly important in their cosmovision, you know, their religion, their understanding of the metaphysical world. You know, they were direct links to the other side, you know. And imagine how difficult it would have been to build a freaking, imagine building like the capital buildings, you know, right above some kind of like underground cave, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and why go through so much trouble? Well, what I argued was maybe they had very good reasons to do that, and maybe those reasons will have to go with these ideas of energy being carried out and transported by water, you know? I mean, I remember that movie, Constantine, with Keanu Reeves, and some people don't like that movie. I happen to like it, and I remember that one part in that movie when he says that water is like the universal conduit, you know, and I think that there's some merit to that idea. You know, we have so many weird Fortean phenomena happening either nearby water systems or on above water systems, you know, where there's mm-hmm. an underground river, you know, there's going to be something happening, you know, a Marian apparition like in Fatima, or
right.
remember Mothman, you know, the Mothman encounters in linked to the Silver Bridge.
And all the superstitions, like, you know, different entities can't cross moving water or
exactly.
underground rivers and things like that, or how ghosts will follow underground rivers.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, I mean, you know, bringing it back to Bigfoot, Bigfoot shows this affinity for water that you don't see with other, you know, primates, other apes especially. There are plenty of documented cases where Bigfoot has been seen using waterways to travel, and even some accounts out of Alaska of Bigfoot being seen swimming like a frog underwater. So I feel like this is some sort of real big linchpin. I know Linda Godfrey's talked about this too, this affinity for water. Some sort of linchpin here that we've been dancing around, and I feel like that would be something really good for somebody to look into.
It's also a key point in David Politis's disappearances, that they're almost always around bodies of water.
That is right.
Yeah.
That is correct. So
all right, let's...
So there's this, you know, and Mexican archaeologists are continuing to carry down their investigation, and there will possibly be some groundbreaking, you know, pardon the pun, discoveries in the near future.
Let's jump across the ocean to England and the discovery of Superhenge.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a much older, much bigger version of Stonehenge that was found, again, using, I believe it was, yeah, remote sensing technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Although none of the stones have yet been excavated, in a unique Sarsen standing have been excavated, a unique Sarsen standing stone, the Cuckoo Stone, remains in the adjacent field and thus suggests other stones may have come from local sources. Previously, intensive study of the area around Stonehenge had led archaeologists to believe that only Stonehenge and a similar henge at the end of the Stonehenge Avenue possessed significant stone structures. The latest surveys now provide evidence that Stonehenge's largest neighbor, Durrington Walls, had an earlier phase which included a large row of standing stones, probably of local origin, and that the context of the preservation of these stones is exceptional and the configuration unique to British archaeology.
Yeah, and the artist depictions of it are pretty stunning.
Yes. And this pushes back, again, the dates of everything, because now you're saying, well, Stonehenge is this old, but this is older.
Yeah, and weren't they saying also that Stonehenge was like some kind of mobile installation that it had been built somewhere else and then transported to it now its current location.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, something to that effect. I probably misremembering, but we know that the stones that you were used to build Stonehenge come from Wales, right?
Mm-hmm.
And which yep. are this pretty far away from where Stonehenge is, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I like the idea of Stonehenge being like a traveling, like almost like that's the old. Yeah, or like the old preachers who used to travel through the South and set up tents. I like that a lot better than the idea that then like you had people dragging stones for 500 years to get to one spot. I like that.
Well, you know, if they had a technology where they could move heavy objects easily, why not move it?
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother can of worms. They're using their Anakithera device.
Yeah, I mean, why would these ancient cultures use stones so immense if they couldn't do it easily?
Yeah. Yeah, why use 5-ton rocks when you can use, 100 smaller stones, I mean?
Yeah.
Because they had to, I guess. It's the answer that someone like John Anthony West would give.
That's really interesting. I'd never thought of it that way, Soraya. But if it wasn't feasible and reasonable, why do it?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a common sense thing, and it's not just one culture that did this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, if you saw one culture, you could say, okay, maybe they had a thing about big rocks, and they were willing to really kill themselves to move these big rocks. But you see it all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if they had if you could move a 50-ton rock like it weighed nothing. Why not use a 50-ton rock?
Yeah, or maybe, I mean, yeah, it makes sense.
Or maybe it wasn't, so easy for them, but they had to do it nonetheless because of some need they had, and this is where someone like Gary Evans and his study of archaeoacoustics would come to maybe give some answers, to the why these civilizations were so adamant to build these megalithic temples.
Possibly. I mean, it definitely shows a connection between these civilizations at some point in the distant past, I would think. Mm-hmm. Either they traded technology or a tradition that made them use these big stones.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we move a little bit southwest of, southeast of that area, we find the Nazca Lines of Asia, which are these massive geoglyphs that were found in Kazakhstan.
Oh, yeah, you've seen Google Maps.
Google Earth.
Google Earth, yeah.
Once again, our technology discovering something very ancient that has been there forever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more than 50 geoglyphs, much like the Nazca lines in Central America, of various sizes and shapes across northern Kazakhstan and Central Asia.
Yeah.
And
once again, the need to build all these symbols that will only be perceived from the sky, And someone like Eric Bondani can say, well, so the astronauts coming to visit us from some other planet would see it as some landing markers. Or I prefer nowadays the idea that they were used for shamanic initiation practices,
Just yeah, very well could be.
Out-of-body experience with the would-be shaman would, have to go and check out all these symbols, and maybe, go and report to their elders, and if he gets it right, he or she passed the test and becomes part of the priesthood.
And we have shapes including squares, rings, crosses, and swastikas. And of course, the article has to point out that the swastika is actually a very ancient symbol.
Yeah,
and it was just kind of stolen by the Nazis later on.
It's amazing the amount of branding that they did with that, isn't it? I mean,
Yeah, it really is.
That you have to backtrack thousands of years of... you have to reassert thousands of years of tradition because of, what, 15, 20 years of use?
Yeah, and it's a very positive ancient symbol. I forget exactly what it means, but it has something to do with life energy.
Yeah.
My interpretation of the swastika is that it was the depiction of a very ancient comet, you know, a four-tailed comet.
Huh, well, that could be.
You know, that was approximately perceived by all these cultures.
In a lot of ways, I think that these particular formations in Kazakhstan are a bit more impressive than the Nazca line because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the Nazca lines, for the most part, are just stones, right? They're just piled stones.
Yeah, what they did is they removed the stones to show the darker earth underneath.
And these are usually pretty large earthen mounds, which I would think would be a lot more difficult than removing stones to make a pattern.
More like the snake structure earthen mound in North America and stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah, also because of the environmental conditions in the Nazca Desert, you know, it preserves these geoglyphs so easily, you know, for hundreds and thousands of years. I will assume that the climate in Kazakhstan is more aggressive for man-made objects.
I do think it's a desert, though.
Oh, then I stand corrected.
Let me double check that, but I do think where they were found is a desert type of area. I mean, it's not overgrown, definitely.
I think it's more like an arid sort of climate situation as opposed to what we think of, you know, sandy desert, right. I believe.
It says many geoglyphs were made with earthen mounds, although one example, a swastika, was made with using timber. It doesn't actually say one way or the other. But if you look at the pictures, it looks like a pretty dry type of area.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's made out of timber, it'd have to be dry to preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to science. Because there were a bunch of big science things that happened. Not that we weren't talking about some science stuff there, but that was sort of the archaeological side. Hubble. Is still running, and it turned, 25? Yeah, 25 years old, the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah, talk about one of the most successful NASA missions of all time.
Yeah, because it wasn't supposed to function this long, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it malfunctioned right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Remember that movie, The Arrival, with Charlie Sheen?
Mm-hmm.
Vaguely.
Yeah, it's not the greatest sci-fi movie, but it has, you know, it has its moments. So basically the idea is that, you know, these alien invaders are slowly terraforming the Earth. And they also, you know, have infiltrated, among other things, NASA. And that, you know, they say to Charlie Sheen, you know, how do you explain that a $1 billion space telescope, you know, is launched and its lenses don't work, right?
Yeah.
So that's the idea, you know. That's, and I'm sure there are a lot of people nowadays who are still thinking in terms of conspiracies and why we haven't returned to the moon, you know. And, well, yeah, because the aliens running NASA, you know, won't let us.
Although it is interesting. I mean, I can't think of anything. Well, this might be controversial, but I can't think of anything that we'd send up today that would last this long. I mean, I feel like the shelf life of a lot of things that we've sent up in the past 5 years, 10 years has been a little bit more. Well,
haven't all the probes we sent to Mars lasted longer than they were expected?
Oh, yeah, Spirit and Opportunity.
Yeah. It seems like NASA probably undersells how long they think things are going to last so they can look more impressive.
Under-promise and over-deliver, right?
Yeah. You know, Voyager wasn't supposed to still be transmitting, and we're still getting data from it.
Yeah.
Hubble certainly wasn't meant to last 25 years. the probes on Mars weren't meant to last as long as they were, and they just keep going. Mm-hmm. Aside from the ones they lose.
Mm.
Which, of course, just went dark, and they're just using them and not telling us about it.
Of course.
Which, you know, I mean, could be. We wouldn't know the difference.
So, do you think that 10, 20 years from now, we'll still have the International Space Station in orbit?
I don't know. I expected something much bigger from the International Space Station by now.
Yeah, but who's going to pay for it?
Yeah, that's the issue.
I've gotten pretty cynical on the efficacy of the public sector space program. And this is probably a talking point that has been beaten into the ground. But when you see what we were able to accomplish from zero to the moon, and to see what we haven't accomplished in the interim, it's all been very disheartening, in my opinion.
That's very true.
Yeah, I mean, to me, one of the things that worries me the most is how we haven't take the appropriate measures in order for us to prevent us to go the way of the dinosaurs, you know, being wiped out by a giant asteroid or a comet. We haven't given enough effort in order to build an appropriate space shield.
Yeah.
We'll defend our civilization from such space impacts. And I wrote something for Mysterious Universe last year about, you know, thinking about the economics of preventing Armageddon, and my own, you know, gullible conclusion is that the private sector will be the only ones capable of doing such a thing, and the only thing that would allow them to do that is by letting them appropriate asteroids, you know, for mining purposes.
Hmm.
You know, that's it. Well, telling them, you know, you can own all the asteroids you want, if you build a space shield that will defend the Earth from asteroid impacts.
Well, I think there's two things that really threaten us. One is things like asteroids, and the other is solar flares.
Carrington event, yep. I was going to say the exact same thing. Yeah.
You know, and those are the two things that we should spare no expense to make sure that our civilization can survive. Something to be able to deflect these asteroids, you know, not blow them up, because apparently that just makes a whole lot of smaller ones that can still do tons of damage, but deflect them off and detect them in the first place. And the solar flare issue isn't that big of a deal. If we just, you know, it's not an expensive fix to protect our power plants and junction boxes and stuff from that type of a flare. But no one wants to put even that little bit of money into it, because they don't. It's not an imminent problem as far as they're concerned.
Yeah.
When have you heard someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson warn us about a Carrington type event?
Yeah. Until, you know, it'll happen, and then they'll be like, oh.
Wow. Well, and it's very sad that, I mean, if you look at it biologically, an asteroid or, you know, a planetary impact is the thing that we should be afraid of. We shouldn't have to worry about solar flares, but we've tied up everything so much in these little tiny boxes with their circuits and their electricity that we've basically, you know, created our own Achilles heel.
Yes. Yes, it would absolutely destroy civilization if we were hit with something the level of the Carrington event now. It would cripple our civilization.
Yep, yep. And it's criminal that no one has done anything about it. I guess we're too busy fighting over our scraps down here in the dog pile. But
it's been presented to Congress numerous times, and they keep turning it down. They don't want to spend the money on it, even though it's not a lot of money to fix it so that this won't happen.
Yeah.
All right, let's see. It's also the 70th anniversary of the first atomic bomb, Trinity.
Yeah. So interesting. Mm. I encourage everyone to go on to YouTube and watch that video of Oppenheimer reciting that little verse from the Bhagavad Gita. the thing that he said right after the first atomic test.
I thought it was from the Mahabharata.
No, it's from the Bhagavad Gita.
Okay,
That the part when it says, "Now I'm become death, the destroyer, destroyer of worlds."
Yeah, the Mahabharata line was when they said, "Is this the first atomic explosion?" He said, "Yes, in modern times," and he had made a quote from the Mahabharata as well from that, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very sobering moment.
I mean, so he was aware that these ancient Indian epics described what very, very well could have been atomic explosions. I mean, it was very, very close to what we see in atomic explosions and the aftermath.
Although I think that this idea of interpreting the Mahabharata in such ways is the result of very poor translations from the original Hindu. I think that someone like Jason Colabito, who I'm not his biggest fan, but I think that he made a very convincing argument that such translations were very modern and only were present in people who were pushing for the ancient alien interpretation.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is sort of a problematic thing. In that sense, because Vimana can mean spaceship. It can also mean temple, though, can't it? I mean,
yes,
yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, and we also still have the human remains in cities in the Indus Valley as Mohenjo-daro, right? Seem to indicate that all those people died very suddenly and at the same time, and some people interpret that as a result of a nuclear blast. But maybe we have to consider other type of catastrophes. Maybe something like, well, what happens if a Carrington-like event triggers some kind of like major natural catastrophe?
Sure. Or even an asteroid impact nearby.
Exactly. Maybe the asteroid impact is what caused the image in Mohenjo-daro, and that's what caused all these glass that is found in some Egyptian jewelry that is very similar to the trinitite kind of minerals that were caused right after the first modern nuclear blast 70 years ago.
Well, I mean, what if a Tunguska-like event happened over a city? I mean, there's no crater from that.
Yeah, no.
But it could have. If it's high enough, it might not destroy all the buildings, but it could kill all the people.
Exactly.
I mean, we can't say there weren't nuclear weapons from some advanced culture at some point in our history, but there's other explanations as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this all ties in, very interestingly with these ideas of nuclear explosions on Mars. Who's the gentleman who brought this up?
Dr.
Brandenburg. Yeah, Brandenburg. I know that Mars is not Earth, but it makes you wonder if there was a civilization capable of producing nuclear explosions on another planet if they might not have visited Earth in the past and done something like that.
Sure. Well.
I can tell you that from a personal point of view, I've been obsessed with nuclear conflagration from an early age. You know, I was drawing nuclear mushrooms when I was in grade school. I think I was traumatized for life after I watched the movie The Day After.
Right, yeah.
Remember that movie? I mean,
I do.
So horrible.
Yeah. It scared the hell out of me as a kid.
Yeah.
I tend to actually, as far as Mars goes, I tend to lean toward Velikovsky's ideas and the Electric Universe ideas that it came into close contact with Venus.
Mm.
And that Venus was more of a comet in the early solar system. I think the Electric Universe people have gone a far way to prove the type of scarring you see on Mars can come from plasma,
mm-hmm.
because they could reproduce it in the laboratories. Mm-hmm. And I think Velikovsky did a good job of showing that Venus was at one point not what it is today. And you had also Laird Scranton's book a few years ago, where it was funny because I read Velikovsky's book and I thought, has anyone checked any of this stuff? Because that was 1950, and now we're sitting here in, at the time, 2013, or maybe 2012 that came out. And I said, has anyone gone and really checked into this and see if this holds up? And there was Laird's book doing exactly that and showing that, yeah, pretty much everything Velikovsky predicted about Venus and related things all held up. Our science has only propped up his theory more rather than destroying it.
Yeah, I like the idea that there was another planet in our solar system that eventually, you know, crashed with Mars, and its debris became the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter.
Right, right. I think the Electric Universe version of that is that when the two planets came close together, there was an exchange of electrical thunderbolts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it literally ripped the surface of Mars off and threw it into space, which became the asteroid belt.
Mm.
And that's something sooner or later we'll be able to prove. I mean, when we get out to the asteroid belt and start doing more and more research on these asteroids and more research on Mars, sooner or later we're going to be able to tell if it's the same thing. So
sorry, we let you down with that long pregnant pause.
I mean, the problem is that won't happen until at least 10, 20 years.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, that's where we're going.
So let's see. We had, I don't know anything about this, Neil Harbison, the first official cyborg?
This is a guy who I think is colorblind. So he implanted some kind of weird ass detector that looks like some kind of antenna growing out of his head, and in some way this antenna vibrates inside his brain and lets him know in some way what kind of color he is watching. And so he somehow managed to convince the authorities to give him the status of a cyborg, you know. So he is officially the first cyborg, and it's a silly story, but it's also like a harbinger of things to come, of people who will take their biology into their own hands. And choose to enhance it using whatever technology they have in hand, right? So now, I think I read recently that Austin has become some kind of capital of DIY biology enhancement. You know, people who are implanting magnets, you know, and inserting them in their arms, you know. And
did you say Austin?
Austin, Texas. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. we were all thinking it.
That's interesting, though. So is the Deep Dream Project, and I don't think I ever fully understood what they were doing with this.
I think it's, well, I'm not a computer scientist, but I think what I understood of it is that this is a computer algorithm that either was developed by Google or it was acquired by Google, and it's used to interpret the data from graphic images, you know, for photographs. And the more you feed it, the more kind of like it learns, you know. And probably, you know, someone who knows more about this is cringing with this poor interpretation of it. But for me, what was interesting is how it managed to show how you will find something like a very crude, very primitive form of artificial intelligence trying to interpret the world using a very, very simple database, you know. So you feed it with some random image, and it spews out, a very bizarre construction of dogs and animal shapes. Why? Because most of the images you find in the internet is of dogs and cats and whatnot, right?
Sure.
So it shows how somehow intelligence interprets the world with the things that it's already inside of, you know, your own database. And that makes you think, well, how does a human intelligence interpret something that is outside its realm of experience? Something like a UFO encounter.
Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. I know I looked at that stuff briefly, and I was a little lost on exactly how it was coming up with the images.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's good. It's a good, yeah, good idea.
We also found water all over the place.
That's one way to put it.
Flowing water on Mars.
Yeah, flowing water on Mars, it was one of those things where it happened, and I went, well, yeah.
Yeah, the reason for that is because someone like, this is a friend of mine, Efrain Palermo. You know, this is a guy who is doesn't have any kind of degrees in astronomy or science, but nevertheless it's like us, you know, he has a penchant curiosity about space and nature. And like 20, 25 years ago, he saw these black and white images on Mars, and he saw this as indication of flowing water. But back in a time when NASA would not even consider the idea of any kind of water on the surface of Mars. You know, Mars for them was a dry world, a world that had always been dry, never had any kind of possibility of ever having any kind of water that would support life, you know. So with that, he did his homework. He presented a paper showing how all these very crude images were the result of flowing water. Barely no one paid attention except a few people, you know, including this guy, I think is Mark Subrin, I think is his name, you know, the founder of the Mars Society. And now then, last year, there was this NASA scientist, you know, confirming that there is indeed flowing water on Mars, and all these, you know, black streaks in these pictures were the result of that. You know, then that's why I said that discovery was an indication that armchair research was something that could benefit science greatly. I don't think that NASA has done enough in order to encourage people to look into that. You know, instead they always make fun of people who go and find all these weird things in Mars. And, you know, and obviously, there are people like Richard Hoagland who are finding, you know, like Bigfoot on Mars, you know, every other day of the week.
Well, everything's artificial to Richard Hoagland, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I really liked his work initially, and then it got to a point where, like, every, you know, all that comet, that's artificial, and that's artificial, and that's, it's like, okay, not everything's artificial.
Exactly.
And if it is, boy, are we in for a wake-up call.
Sorry, and there's people finding like rats and gerbils and reptiles and people on Mars and all these pictures taken by the rovers and by the satellites orbiting Mars. But At the same time, there are people who are using that data, that raw data that is, you know, freely available on the NASA databases, and they're making good science with it, you know. But
yeah.
Problem is that they're not getting the recognition for it.
And I would say there's definitely some odd looking stuff both on the moon and Mars, but I'm not going to say they're artificial till we get, I don't know, someone there to look at it, maybe a moving image of things where you can get more of a perspective at least.
Yeah.
You know, pictures can be deceiving, unfortunately.
Yeah.
We also found a global ocean under Saturn's moon Enceladus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is not the first moon that we've confirmed any kind of liquid on. There's at least one around Jupiter.
Europa.
Yes, thank you. And didn't they say something, too, that Pluto had some signs of liquid?
Mm-hmm. Blue ice and water.
Yeah. So there's just water just seems to be a common component to everything.
Yeah. And where's water?
There's potential of life.
In our current understanding of the world, yeah.
and apparently supernatural phenomena.
Exactly.
They released, as Red Pill wrote it here, a mother load of Apollo pics.
More fodder for the conspiracy wing, yeah.
Yeah, they're all people looking for UFOs on Apollo pictures.
And again, even if you see something that's out of place, it doesn't prove what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's been plenty of space footage from the space station, from the space shuttle and stuff that has some very odd stuff on it. And you see it, you go, okay, I can't tell you what that is. That doesn't prove it's an extraterrestrial.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, some of it's probably natural phenomenon. Some of it's definitely natural phenomena. Whether or not we've ever identified what that phenomena is another thing entirely. Mm. Some of it is definitely misidentified junk and stuff like that. But some of it could be anomalous. I mean, there's no way really to know. All you're getting is an image with some movement to it. It doesn't prove what it is one way or the other. And unless you can say, it's this piece of space junk that we've been tracking and we've known about for a long time, and there it is, and, you know, then you can dismiss it.
Well, yeah, and if I have any real criticism of this community in which I've become so enamored with in the past 3 years, it would definitely be that we have this tendency to want everything to be all one thing or not one thing. You know, we don't do a very good job of sitting with the messiness of the mystery, as Terrence McKenna would say. And I think that anybody who's involved in this, I mean, you need to accept the fact that some things that you see are misidentifications. Some are preternatural. There are things that, you know, are natural that we just don't have a working knowledge of scientifically. And some things are lies, and some things are actual genuine anomalies. And those are the things that are interesting. All of them are worthy of our study, but you can't say that anything that doesn't conform to what we know is automatically a UFO.
Well, it's a UFO by definition of unidentified flying object.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was dipping into the pop culture pool there. yes, it's,
I know
they're always UFOs, but they're not always genuine, you know. Anomalies.
Sometimes they become IFOs, and sometimes they don't.
Right,
mm-hmm.
UAPs.
So you would,
one thing on. That didn't happen last year is that Virgin Galactic hasn't launched their service of commercial spaceflight. You know, you guys have followed the news about Virgin Galactic. When are these guys going to finally start sending people out into, you know, orbit?
I don't know. They've been very careful about their launches and stuff. I mean, they've done some promising stuff, but
yeah, I've been under the impression that it keeps on getting just pushed back.
Almost instantly.
Well, they don't want to screw it up. That's for sure.
Sure. I mean, they don't want to incinerate Will Smith and all those people, you know,
exactly
in their maiden flight. But obviously, one of the things that I'm looking forward with the dawn of commercial spaceflight is more people being sent into space and maybe possibly seeing all this weird stuff that's happening, you know, within the orbit of our planet, all these quote-unquote fast walkers and all these weird lights that were only seen by Apollo astronauts who were under oath, maybe, of not disclosing whatever happened during those missions.
True.
Red, I'm under the impression, just from what I've remember about Virgin Galactic, is I think that the crash that they had back in late 2014 probably spooked them. I don't know if you recall that, but died and one was injured. Yeah, one of the pilots died and one was injured. So, yeah, but as far as like a hard date, I have not really heard anything in a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we have the same thing happened with the Apollo mission, you know, where Gus Grissom and his companions died while testing the capsule of Apollo 1, but NASA was under a mission to fulfill Kennedy's vision to put a man on the moon before the end of the decade, and that's why, you know, despite the sad tragedy of these men dying for their country, they kept doing what they had to do. And obviously, Virgin Galactic is not under the same kind of vision, and that's maybe, yeah, because they were more concerned of keeping their image and keeping up with a good PR and actually, you know, doing what they had to do in order to finally putting people into low orbit.
Well, also you got to consider back then with the Apollo missions, we were also racing against Russia.
Allegedly, I mean, we still don't know how ahead were the Russians. You know, how what were the capabilities and how close they really were of putting a man to the moon.
True.
Yeah, I wonder if there was an ISIS space program, if we would be on Mars yet.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And the last bit of science news that we have here on the list was the interstellar drive.
Oh yeah, the EM drive.
Wow. And that was one of those things that came out and they said, "Oh, we've made a warp drive," and tons of people came out and said, "No, they didn't. No."
And you'll never hear anything about it ever again.
Yeah.
It's almost gotten, and that's the sad thing, is it's almost gotten hard for me to get excited about things like this, because I feel like you hear these really promising things and then there never feels like there's this any real follow through.
Oh my God, you're turning into Team B now.
These habituators, so, man, put up or shut up. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it was interesting while it was out there, but now I haven't. It really just disappeared. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, I had forgotten about it until you mentioned it just now.
So, all right, let's get into some weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There was an article about this mummified Buddhist monk,
mm-hmm.
and he is supposedly still alive. He self-mummified himself. And how many hundreds of years has it been?
Oh, I barely remember.
Let's see if I can find the article. But it's been quite a while. It's not, you know, well beyond a human lifespan.
Yeah, I mean, it's really strange. I think looks like it was in a meditative state called Thuc Dam.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think there was another similar story of a Buddha statue, and they used some kind of scanner, and they found that there was this monk, you know, inside the statue, you know. So something very similar to this other monk that attained this kind of, according to the story, you know, inanimate state, you know, suspended animation, I think.
Yeah, because he's supposedly still meditating.
Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of something that I recently found in some Spanish news sites about this alleged finding of the tomb of some Nephilim giants in Iraq. So these giants apparently are also in some kind of suspended animation. You know, and there's these really crappy videos on YouTube, you know, circulating in these websites, allegedly showing these, you know, giants, you know, with these, you know, Sumerian-like headdresses. And obviously, these are nothing but statues, you know, made out of wax or something, you know, but this is the same idea that these are Nephilim, that they're not dead, they're only in some kind of suspended animation.
I mean, I guess if you as a monk could slow your bodily functions, and we know they can slow down their heartbeats and so on and so forth, I suppose if you could slow it down enough, you could potentially still be alive and in a state of suspended animation.
Well, I mean, there's precedent for it elsewhere in biology. I mean, just today there was news about the tardigrade that was revived after 30 years. The little water bear.
Yeah.
Oh.
Had been dormant for 30 years, and they revived it, and it's reproducing again. And now, of course, it's a giant step from that to, you know, complex mammals. But, you know, theoretically, I suppose, I feel like stranger things have happened.
and it always makes me wonder about consciousness in cases like that. If someone were to go into that type of a state and then be brought back,
mm-hmm.
would their consciousness have some continuity? Would it seem like, oh, just yesterday I started meditating to get into that state, and here I am 20 years later? Or would they wander somewhere else? You know, would it just shut down or what?
Almost like a computer in sleep mode.
Yeah.
And then when it comes back on, it realizes that it was like, you know, an early IBM.
But will it seem like a second ago to that individual? I mean, time's hard to understand from our perspective. I mean, I always like the definition of time passes according to, like, how much your brain can process at one moment. So the more stuff that's going on, the faster time moves. The less that's going on, the slower time moves, because time is dictated by your brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's why when you're a child, you know, you think that the days last so long, you know, the summers were so endless, you know, you had to wait so long for Christmas.
But right,
then you're older and you know, deal with more stuff, you feel that time, you know, is speeding up.
Yep. And you know, anytime you're having a good time and doing a lot of stuff, time flies. But if you're sitting there bored out of your mind, it's like, oh, come on, where's that next hour I need?
Well, my two thoughts are, I've noticed something where I feel like sometimes I wonder if time is not a fixed, if it doesn't go at a fixed pace. Because a lot of times I will find, if I'm talking with somebody, and I've been really busy, and I've noticed that the time has flown by in my life, they'll notice it as well in their life, which makes me wonder if perhaps we're, you know, sometimes the conveyor belt that we're all on speeds up for everyone.
Certainly a possibility. I would think it's more relative to the person, though.
Yeah, I definitely do, and that sort of brings me to the other point. Is I'm listening to the Serial podcast, and this season they're covering Bo Bergdahl, who was held by Al-Qaeda for, he was held in Afghanistan for 5 years. And he talks about how he actually made a request. One of the things that he was able to have done for him was that they would remove clocks wherever he was, because having nothing to do, it just became absolutely interminable. And he really lost... Sometimes he'll be in a blacked out room for weeks at a time, and he would just completely lose all sense of time. which is a horrifying thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's this idea that some people have suggested, you know, even myself considered it, that at the moment of death, you know, that last moment of consciousness, time would become still, you know, to the point that, you know, that single moment will become, from your point of preference, almost eternal. So that would be an interesting way into solving the idea of the survival of consciousness after death, and even reconciling with the idea of people who think that consciousness is only generated by the brain, you know. So that will be a way in which an atheist will think that, yeah, the life continues after death indefinitely, from your own personal preference point.
I think that came out of a study where they found that there was a large amount of DMT released at the point of death in rats.
Mm-hmm.
And since DMT can nullify the sense of time, they said, well, if this happens in people at the point of death, then maybe they're on an eternal DMT trip that seems timeless to them, even though they're dead here.
Yeah.
That makes a great deal of sense, given the, you know, sort of time dilation that users of DMT report. It makes a lot of sense.
However, there's no evidence that DMT burst happens at the end of a human's death.
So I wonder if there would be a way to find if there are large traces of DMT inside the brain of that mummified monk.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Let's see. There was a UFO video from Puerto Rico you wrote down. Now, what was this?
This is one of the last news that hit the Fortune newsreel in 2015. You know, Open Minds talked about it. So this is, I think, something that was recorded by some kind of Homeland Security.
Okay, I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that, I think this video is from 2014, actually. But it was.
Yeah, but it made news at the end of last year. Yeah.
Yes, it was somehow it was released. I mean, someone gave permission for it to be released, and it shows this really weird ass, seems like a light, like moving around in this black and white video. And apparently there was this group formed by who knows what kind of people who analyzed the video and concluded that it wasn't the product of some kind of drone or some kind of human known technology, and it wasn't also some kind of bird or some kind of animal or some kind of... So there was no explanation for what the video showed.
Yeah. No easy explanation anyway.
Yeah, but then, okay, so where does that bring us? You know, what's the conclusion? So it's an interesting video for sure. You know, in a way it's completely meaningless, but I think it leaves so many questions unanswered. So by who exactly recorded the video, who decided to release the video, I think it's more interesting than what is actually shown.
And it's not in full color, it's in infrared, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, you know, because those are the kind of cameras that presumably are used by, you know, Homeland Security.
Right.
Teams, you know, I mean, it makes sense. You know, these guys are not using like color cameras.
Yeah, and all right. I was just going to throw in my two cents. The most convincing counter argument that I've heard to being some sort of legitimate unknown, well, that sort of takes the wind out of the sails of the idea that it's an anomalous fast-moving craft or the possibility that Greg Bishop mentioned on Radio Misterioso about possibly the angle of the craft that the aircraft that it was taken from, this video, was actually providing the illusion that it was being more maneuverable than it actually was. But it's still, I still think that it's quite compelling. It's some of the most compelling footage that's been released in, well, I would say probably all of last year, from what I recall.
And Puerto Rico has always been a hot spot for UFOs and other paranormal sort of stuff.
For everything, yeah.
The birth of the chupacabras.
Yes, yes. All right, let's move into entertainment for a few moments here. There were two movies we didn't talk about. The one I definitely think had some interesting elements to it was Ex Machina, or Ex Machina, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yep.
And which
didn't get an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, it was a very well done movie, which brought up the concept of consciousness in machines.
Yeah. So.
And at what?
Why do you think that a machine could be conscious?
See, that's really hard to say. I think anything could be conscious. It's just a matter of how we define consciousness.
See, I feel like the idea of humankind creating consciousness would be, I feel like consciousness is so fundamental that it would almost be like saying mankind, you know, do you think mankind will ever create time, or mankind will ever create space? Yeah. You know, I don't think we can create space. I don't think we can create time. And I certainly think that, I mean, it might happen accidentally, but I don't think that we can set out to create consciousness as we know it and have it created.
I think we could create a tool that consciousness could inhabit.
Yeah, something so organized, you know, that it could somehow not generate consciousness, but somehow, you know,
be used by consciousness.
Yeah, exactly.
But it would also have to have some element of free will, because without free will is there real consciousness. Otherwise, it's just following programming.
Yeah, because I think that the idea that an AI intelligence that will only be guided by logic, to me, it's kind of like it would be at like a dead end. I think that consciousness needs some kind of drive. And in our case, that drive is generated by emotions, you know, and by instinct. Yeah. The drive to feed, the drive to mate, you know, the drive to survive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, either you program the artificial intelligence in order to create simulated emotions, simulated drives, simulated instincts, or somehow those instincts are generated by itself.
And we may already be in a simulation, and all those things may simply be programmed into us.
Sure, maybe an advanced alien intelligence will look at us, and they wouldn't even think that we are, quote-unquote, alive, not as alive as they are.
Well, look at those apes down there. They just respond to the same basic, you know, instincts as anything else down there.
Yeah, they think they're conscious. They're poor subs.
And it's always interesting. Like, I was talking to Cheryl Lee Black a few weeks ago on the show about her near-death experiences. And I asked her, you know, a lot of times people who have near-death experiences say it's more real than real.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what does that mean exactly? What does that mean to, you know, when you say that? And she said, it was kind of like all her senses were jumbled together and everything came in at once.
Interesting.
And so when you think about that, it's like, is that us without the programming?
Yeah, I think the closest you can relate to that is like, you know, you're driving at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, you're kind of dozed off, you know, you're still half asleep, thinking about all the problems that await you the moment you reach to the office, and then suddenly you have to hit the brakes because you're about to crash with another vehicle, you know, and at that single moment that's when you are fully awake.
Right.
When you, you know, and then you are fully there in that single moment, and that's when you reality hits you, and that's when probably what these people are saying it's something like that, but like 100 times over.
Right, right. They're really woken up to reality as opposed to what we think of as reality.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've often wondered that same thing, Sarai, because you hear that in abduction reports a lot too.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're so closely connected, abduction reports and near death experiences. There's a lot of similarities. Yeah,
absolutely.
Which there shouldn't be if they were extraterrestrial.
What are the Christians waiting for? Isn't the rapture? I mean, rapture is basically kidnapping. You know, they're waiting to be abducted by Jesus.
And the other kind of interesting movie that had some subtle Fortiana type themes was Tomorrowland.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah, I loved it too. I liked it way more than I expected to.
I did not see it.
What?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Ah, shame on you.
So yeah. I'll bow out until I do, but I will.
Well, without giving too much away, I mean, it definitely goes with the idea of a breakaway civilization. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. As well as the concept of other sort of like other realities within our own.
Mm-hmm. Parallel universe. And also our current obsession with Armageddon. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, sci-fi in the last 20, 25 years has always focused on dystopias. You know, how civilization is going to break down and everything is going to go to hell. And, you know, everything is going to look like Mad Max and we're all just going to be, you know, fighting for survival. And that wasn't the case, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Everybody expected the world to get better and better thanks to science.
Yep. I think, you know, I love the concept of an Armageddon. not that I want there to be an Armageddon. I love the concept, though, because I think the world needs to be shaken up.
Okay.
You know, just as a symbol, because we get so complacent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as a society, the only thing that's going to shake us out of that is something really horrific, where we have to, you know, when you see some of these natural disasters and you see what good people can do, where they just come out of the woodwork to help other people, and you're like, wow, you know, we're a really amazing race of beings when the chips are down.
Right.
So the concept of an Armageddon is like, okay, I don't actually want this to happen, but imagine if it did, because it would, in a sense, bring out the best of us. Yep. It would shake up our worlds, and we'd stop worrying about these stupid, not important things and freaking out about them and realize what's really important to us.
Mm-hmm. Also, yep. Because I mean, people get together and become more, there's a sense of solidarity at the face of really, really big natural catastrophes. That's what happened in Mexico in 1985, after we were hit by a really horrible earthquake that killed, I don't know how many people, you know, probably more than 500,000. Who knows, you know. But there was this idea of, you know, that joining forces and overcoming this all together. You know, that's it's the paradox of the human species, you know, that the best of us shines during the worst of times.
Yeah, yeah. And too bad it can't just always shine.
Yeah, yeah.
But our society is also made to kind of, you know, that consumerist sort of mindset does not bring out the light in people.
And also because our civilization is the only one who has fully believed the idea, the concept of linear time, right?
Instead of cyclic time.
Yeah, instead of cyclic time, we are obsessed with this fetishism of progress, of all of this, you know, unbroken arrow for always forward. Whereas, like you said, you know, our ancestors thought in cycles, that everything that progresses in circles, everything that were forward eventually will have to go back to this, and return to the origin.
Right.
And I would argue that the very act of seeing, I mean, part of the reason that when things are good, we aren't compassionate is because when things are good, we're able to, you know, really insulate ourselves. And I think that the reason that you see such compassion in the face of tragedy is because people are faced with the very real, you know, the fragility of humanity right in front of their very eyes that you don't get if you, you know, if everything is stable and you've gone home for the night and you get to, you know, to tuck yourself into your bed and lock up your house, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the internet has hurt and helped that in a sense. Like, it's helped because people all over the world can now connect with people in any other part of the world and they can help them out. But there's also people who, you know, oh, well, I'll post this status on Facebook and that's me doing something, or, you know, something that really doesn't do anything except draw attention to that person themselves because, you know, hey, they're helping, but they're not really helping.
Well, and anonymity has also been, you know, aided hate outright, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
People do and say things that they would never say in person. I've who was that? Some personality I was listening to had to ban someone from their forums, and they actually ended up meeting them in person. They were just completely regular, normal, quite pleasant people.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, you get them behind a keyboard where they don't think anything will come back to them, and they you know, turn into Mr. Hyde.
They don't have to stand up for what they're saying. They can say whatever they want. They control people. They can be, you know, the most unpleasant of people, and they never have to be responsible for it.
Right.
Yeah. Christopher Ryan, who spent a lot of time in Spain, you know, he notice how in Spanish language the word aislar means both to insulate as well as to isolate. And so it's an interesting idea how, you know, you try to insulate yourself from the rest of the world, you end up isolated from the rest of the world.
All right. And the last on the entertainment list was Obama was on Jimmy Kimmel. Did UFOs get brought up in that?
As always. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel certainly seems to be kind of obsessed with the idea of aliens. I think that there was this sketch that was aired on his show with David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, you know, for the upcoming remake of the X-Files. So, well, in this show in 2015, Kimmel had President Obama, and he made the same question as he brought up to President Bill Clinton, that if he was going to be elected president, the first thing that he will do will be to ask for all the files about Roswell, because he wants to know what happened there. And that was the perfect opportunity for Obama to make the same kind of lame-ass joke that, oh, well, you know, the aliens wouldn't let us, you know, reveal the truth because they control us and whatever, right?
That sounds about right. And lately you've had Hillary Clinton talking about UFOs as well.
Mm-hmm. And claiming that if she is elected, she will get to the bottom of it.
To the bottom of Area 54 in New Mexico, right? Wasn't that the line?
Is that what she said?
I really do think it was, if I remember correctly.
Well, but let us remember that James Podesta, who worked for her husband, President Clinton, yep, is not only a big fan of the X-Files, but he's also been very vocal about trying to put an end to the government cover-up. I mean, he even tweeted about that last year, yeah, you know, that how one of his biggest regrets was that he didn't manage to bring an end to the UFO secrets. And most of the mainstream media obviously made fun of that. But, you know, it kind of shows that even people in those circles are really, really interested into getting into the bottom of this mystery.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that covers most of the important alternative stories for 2015. There could have been some. There's probably some we missed.
Well, it's funny because it felt like sort of a down year, but as we've proved over the past three shows, there was some stuff to talk about. That's for sure.
And some of it was minor things that I think is going to lead to more later. You're seeing more of this, more of our technology of discovering ancient sites being used. You know, whether it be Google Earth or this ground penetrating radar or whatever, it's telling us a lot more than we ever could have discovered before.
Mm-hmm.
So these stories in themselves may not be a huge deal, but the potential for what they can do in the world and in the future, it's just going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the 3D printing, the DNA analysis, and all this other stuff. And as we've said, dates keep getting pushed back further and further.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's just going to keep on happening too. That's my 2016 prediction.
It's
just going to keep on backing up.
And, you know, I mean, as backwards as science may be sometimes, it's achieved some pretty, pretty amazing stuff. I just wish it was a little more open-minded. I think it could achieve a whole lot more.
Yeah. I think it's its own worst enemy in some ways.
Yeah. Well, you have, I posted an article on, Science's confirmation bias on the Where the Road Go Facebook that I think nailed it right on the head. And as I said, I'm a proponent of the electric universe theory. I think their theory makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And they completely throw out the Big Bang theory. And this article was talking about how, you know, they keep trying to keep the Big Bang theory alive, even though the evidence is not supporting it. And this is what the electric universe people have been saying for a long time, that the evidence simply doesn't support it. It's just a confirmation bias at this point. They take whatever data they get and try to squeeze it in. And when it doesn't fit, they go, well, it must be dark matter. Yeah, dark matter. That's it. And then they look for dark matter and they can't find it. But they're not going to stop because they know it must be out there because they know they're right about the Big Bang theory.
You got to work backwards from our conclusions.
Yeah. We'll have to take comfort in remembering that science advances one funeral at a time.
Yeah, unfortunately. And I really wish that wasn't the case, because I have no problem with the scientific method. I have no problem with the concept of science. It's just sometimes it's so damn stubborn. Although it is nice to see people like Graham Hancock slowly get more and more vindicated as things he said were going to turn out to be true turn out to be true.
Mm-hmm. But then again, do we want the Graham Hancock to become fully mainstream?
I don't think Graham will do.
it's like asking to David Bowie to be, you know, fully mainstream. You know, I mean, do you really want that? You know, maybe there's a reason why these guys need to remain in the periphery. You know, and that's why they have a bigger impact in our culture.
I don't know. I think Bowie was pretty mainstream.
Well, he was never knighted. He wasn't Sir David Bowie.
I don't think that Bowie. Well, this is a conversation for a larger discussion. But I think that Bowie bent the mainstream to him more than he became mainstream in a lot of ways.
That could be. Yeah. He definitely influenced enough people.
Yeah, but the moment that he felt that everybody was acting like him, that's when he then changed his persona and became something else.
And as much as I like Alice Cooper, Alice Cooper was the opposite way. Mm. Alice Cooper looked at whatever was going around and said, yeah, I'll do that. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But yeah, Bowie definitely was ahead of the curve. He was the one leading the curve.
For sure.
And we're planning on doing a show on David Bowie and the occult, and maybe just rock and stuff and the occult in general. We'll see where it goes. Not that any of our shows ever wander off like they don't have a road in front of them.
It's part of the joy.
Exactly. So I thank you guys. That was part three of our 2015 top 2015 alternative news stories. And yeah, like I said, we'll be back. Probably the next show with you guys will be the one on David Bowie.
Sounds good.
And his occult connections.
Looking forward to it. A pleasure as always, Soraya.
Mm-hmm.